Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast, coming to you from sunny Singapore. Big welcome to our guest for this session, Tom Simpson, VP APAC Ad Colony. We talked about the job title. Have I completely ruined that?
You looked at me like
maybe I should have a longer job title, but you also just told me that you hate longer job titles.
That's exactly what happened.
Your face said was
lost
hilarious.
Here.
Exactly.
Wait,
how it shook down.
3 seconds ago, we confirmed this, but it's gone. I'm sorry, it's gone.
Also, is Singapore sunny this morning? I'm not sure.
Rainy Singapore.
I don't want to misrepresent Singapore to all the people out there.
Totally just ruined my
intro. It was a frigging
there,
monsoon as well, so no, it's not sunny at all.
And of course, the other reason that I'm getting so much hassle here on the podcast this morning is because my fellow guest is Lindsay Rowntree, head of content, doubling up a sound guy.
Hi.
How's it going there, Lindsay?
Really well.
Good.
I'm very on top of things.
That's good. So am I. You've definitely, listeners, got the jet lag crew this morning, but we'll battle through.
Can I just say it's very exciting to see this in person because I'm an avid listener of the Mad Tech Podcast. But seeing you do your intro where it's like, hi, Lindsay, how are you? The connection between you guys.
And 20 minutes chatting to us as well, so it all seems rather superfluous, but never mind.
It's good.
All I can say, Tom, is that you need to tune in a couple of weeks' time for our, I think it's the week of Christmas or the week before Christmas.
No, it should be the week before.
Week before Christmas for the...
2 weeks' time.
Yeah, for the Exchange Wire team podcast. So we recorded a special team podcast.
Wowzers.
Which was Kieran, me, Lindsay and Matt Broughton, our Exchange Wire editor. And you just tune in.
It was quite the ridiculous
circus, shall we say.
It's going to be festive fun.
It's festive. It is festive. Yeah.
But anyway, let's get on with talking about some news of the week with a little bit of an APAC focus, since that's where we are. First news story I wanted to chat with you guys about, which is actually huge, and we somehow missed it off the schedule of news stories last week, which is that Yahoo Japan and Line have merged. Now, I don't know if here in APAC you caught this a little bit quicker than we did. I don't know what we were doing over in Europe. I think we also blame the fact that we had the wires and various other things going on.
Oh, absolutely. You're all out partying.
Too busy partying, missing the news. Yahoo Japan and Line in a merger, which is really interesting because it sort of sets themselves up as potentially tackling other competitors from the US and China. So Line, we would sort of categorize as a super utility app. So it's not just a messaging app, but it became popular as a messaging service, and particularly in markets within APAC like Japan, Taiwan and Thailand. But it offers loads of other functionality, therefore falling into the super utility category from our point of view. And of course, Yahoo Japan, owned by SoftBank, who frankly seem to have the depthiest pockets in the world.
Depthiest.
Is that a word?
I don't know.
Am I inventing things again?
Normally it's deepest, but I prefer depthiest. So
I think we should
move to depthiest. The OED is going to be...
The last time we were recording this podcast in Singapore was the letter post door slot incident.
Yeah.
Do you remember that one, Tom?
Oh, I don't. But
okay,
I'm
you might
have
need
to
tune into that. All I can say is an ad tech luminary came up to me at Mexico this year and said, "Really enjoy the podcast. Love the letter door post slot episode."
Great.
Anyway, let me ask the two of you what you make of this merger between Yahoo Japan and Line, because is it a big competition play for the US and China? What's going to be the impact of bringing those two together? Are we talking about adding significant potential funding to Line as a super utility app? Or is it something that we're just super interested in from an outsider's perspective? Is this just business as usual in an APAC market where consolidation was perhaps inevitable? Tom?
I mean, there's so much to unpack here. Mm. I mean, the comment from a spokesperson at GAFA, who it was exactly, we'll never know, was basically too small. And then I imagine they turned around and walked out of the room. It's an interesting merger. It gives them about 100 million users in Japan, creates a $30 billion combined business. I mean, it's sizable, but whether they will have the scope to move out beyond Japan. I mean, Japan's had issues scaling across Southeast Asia. You look at what happened with Rakuten, tried to get out there, do e-commerce business, scaled back in 2016. So Japan has had challenges. But I mean, there's already a decent footprint out there. It's interesting what they've done in Thailand, where it really is. I mean, it's a bit of a kind of a super app in Japan and other bits, but Thailand,
but not elsewhere.
Well, but Thailand, it's really pushed on really expanded out. And in Thailand, they went into a joint venture with a Thai business, 50-50. And that kind of really allowed it to grow. And I think one of the interesting things about super apps is we've seen them kind of emerge in parts of Asia where infrastructure and regulation has perhaps been not as strong, not as all pervasive. You know, the rise of the super apps is the rise of emerging Asia. So somewhere like Japan, which is quite similar to the US in that there's a lot of existing infrastructure, a lot of existing regulation, there's less scope for super apps to grow, to make life easier, to remove friction from all these different transactions of everyday life, whereas somewhere like China or Thailand or Indonesia, so much scope for these apps to grow. I mean, I was in New York a few months ago, and I hadn't been for years. And one of the things that absolutely amazed me was the difficulty not only of paying with PayWave, but of paying with Apple Pay. And I mean, certainly no chance of doing a kind of online wallet or a QR code payment, you know, anywhere I went. I went to the subway and they wanted me to pay in cash at the ticket booth. And I was kind of like, are we back in the 1950s here or something?
Don't you know I live in Asia? What's wrong with you?
No, totally. But I mean, parts of China, they won't, you know, they're not interested in cash because cash is potentially counterfeit. It's difficult to handle. Yeah. Everything's just done through, you know, the super app of choice, which is probably WeChat, maybe Alipay. I mean, it's interesting. It's interesting in the Japanese market, but whether they can actually kind of scale it across the rest of Asia, I mean, that's the big bet and the big play.
Yeah, interesting. And why, just for a second, why is Line taken off specifically in Thailand, perhaps as opposed to other messaging apps? Is it just they got in early or...?
No idea.
No, they did Southeast Asia.
Well, they did get in. They got in 2013, and they did this JV, and that enabled them to scale up. I mean, they've got, you know, the services they have there, such as Line TV, which is, you know, decent content, huge kind of consumer viewer numbers that they don't have anywhere else.
Yeah.
Indonesia, I mean, they had 30 million users in Indonesia at one point, but I think they're down to maybe 15 million now. And they started a little bit later in Indonesia. They tried to go in, do the whole thing themselves, didn't work quite as well. So I think it was the partnership in Thailand that really kind of helped them, along with being a little bit earlier in the market. So they got the opportunity to get across a lot of these things.
Yeah. Interesting. Lindsay, what's your point of view? And did you have to pay in cash on the subway when you were recently in New York?
Yes, but also in Singapore.
Oh, yes.
We had to buy a metro card on the MRT.
This is a bit weird. When you buy your first MRT card, the transaction has to be in cash, which is really weird. Okay. And it's very un-Asian.
Of course, very un-Asian.
We were both really surprised.
New York, not surprised. Disgrace.
It's a disgrace. Yeah, it is a disgrace. I'd like to complain.
Yeah. Singapore needs to be ejected from Asia.
Absolutely. But I mean, once you've got your MRT card, then it's all fine.
It lasts for like 5 years, so you're good.
It does.
Yeah. But no, I wasn't surprised in New York to pay with cash, but I was very surprised in Singapore to pay with cash, which gives you speaks volumes about what each market is like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like the way the payment options in the States are.
They are ridiculous.
Archaic.
They are utterly ridiculous. I haven't been for a couple of years, but I mean, you're still signing for things. You're still handing over a credit card and actually signing for stuff.
So absolutely. But I mean, it's where you've got an infrastructure that sort of works and sort of does the job. Then there's little incentive to kind of move on.
Yeah. Mm. And again, as you pointed out with Japan and Japan being comparable to the US it's legacy. There's so much legacy infrastructure. Yeah. And it's a bit like, you know, in the West, the reason that we're so behind APAC when it comes to, well, like parts of Asia, where it comes to payment is because there's the credit card exists.
Yeah.
And the credit card has existed since the 60s. And actually that is our legacy infrastructure. And as you get rid of the credit card, you get rid of all the kind of payment woes. And then we can go to more comfortably to PayWave, even using Apple Pay and Android Pay. We're still tied to cards.
Yeah.
But actually, when you've got the likes of Alipay, that is just your own money. You can upload, you can always use a bank account. Yeah. And that's what the challenger brands in the West, like Monzo and Revolut, are trying to do. But it's being done over here. Like, you guys just sit here rolling your eyes, probably. Like,
Well, it's, but I mean, you know, it's things like really boring stuff, like the payment clearing systems are built to work at a cost that is sustainable in Western markets, but is not sustainable here.
Elsewhere,
so,
yeah.
You know, so he's kind of forced to evolve and innovate here.
Mm. Yeah, but I guess, so back to Line and Yahoo Japan, or Zed Holdings, as they are called, kind of, because that's what they'll will be called. Mm. I mean, so it's not supposed to go through till next year, pending some governmental regulation, because what I read, you know, South Korea and Japan have their government
special
issues, so they need to kind of work that out. But it, I mean, from my perspective, when we look at what's happening in APAC, and we talk about the super apps like WeChat, and then you've got Grab and you've got GoCheck that have just come out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And Line used to be kind of spoken of synonymously with WeChat in the West, and it's not anymore. So Line can't even scale in Japan, which is, it's apart from the fact that it's like owned by a Korean company, that's a challenge. So actually by merging with Yahoo Japan, it does bring things together. And Yahoo Japan's problem has been that it struggled with cell phone services. It struggled with being able to give people what they need that they can get in other markets. And that's maybe again why in Japan they can't scale any further than they already are. But I do find your point, Tom, very interesting about the fact that regulation stops Japan from being able to kind of have this explosion of super apps that kind of every other like Asian market is able to been able to take advantage of.
Yeah.
So does that not mean that the same thing will happen with this new Yahoo Japan Line merger? Because it's owned by a Japanese and a Korean company. Well, they still, and they're trying to scale obviously in Southeast Asia, trying to scale in North Asia as well. But they're also trying to scale in their home market. Won't they encounter the same problems? Regulation.
I think possibly they will. I mean, in the home market, but the hope is that they can push out and find other markets, and that by kind of combining with SoftBank. There's a new one. Nice soft place, a comfortable place to sleep. SoftBank.
I believe
that sounds like a DTC. I've just invented a DTC.
I believe they have depthiest pockets. SoftBank.
Okay, that is definitely a DTC. I'm setting that up. Nobody buy DoftBank.com.
Oh my God, you said DoftBank now.
It's getting worse.
Things are literally going downhill.
Yeah, okay.
You've not got the jet lag excuse either, Tom.
No, exactly. Too much coffee. Yeah. Okay, so SoftBank, I mean, how much money do they have to put into innovation and to drive the business?
Have they not lost it all by investing in WeWork? Like, I don't understand.
Yeah, I don't know. I think they're visionary. I think Sun is a visionary. I think, you know, trying to build a company for the next 300 years is an incredible thing to do.
Yeah.
I think what they did with the Vision Fund, getting 100 billion, you know, available and sticking that into tons of, you know, totally transformational next generation businesses is a mad thing to do.
Take their office smooth as well.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, they inflated valuations by investing a lot themselves, but there are also a lot of other businesses. I mean, a lot of American VCs
that
and VCs that have done the same and invested into the same businesses that SoftBank, you know, Vision Fund went into. SoftBank is down 30% from the top, which was sometime in July before WeWork went, went pear-shaped. I think SoftBank is a really interesting business and would actually be a pretty decent buy right now, because I still think their long-term strategy is absolutely right, and they're across, you know, so much interesting stuff.
Well, they've certainly shown the ability to diversify their investments because they just get involved in so many different things, which is the thing that makes them interesting, I think.
Yeah.
And you're right, maybe they get an unnecessary bad rap from the US press, who are slightly sort of sniggering. Well, also they love, like a lot of Western press outfits, they love a bad story, right? So everyone's sort of slightly sniggering behind hands about how WeWork's just falling to pieces.
It's scandal and gossip.
Yeah,
we love that.
Exactly, and that SoftBank just keeps sort of pouring money into Ballot out. But actually, that, you know, if you think about it, that's more of a failure story of the sort of culture of WeWork than anything to do with the investment world, because, like you say, they've only done what plenty of other VCs and investors have done.
Yeah.
Connecting what the two of you have just mentioned in terms of sophistication of infrastructure and opportunities for this Line and Yahoo Japan merger in other markets in APAC. The fact that we've just talked about, you know, infrastructure in the US, which is often comes from US born and bred companies like Apple doesn't operate in the same seamless way that it that sort of similar infrastructure operates here. Doesn't that give Line and Yahoo Japan a little bit of an edge over US incumbents in other APAC markets? The fact that they better understand the potentially the population, perhaps they've got slightly more nimble infrastructure, shall we say, because the Americans tend to, I mean, I'm making just such vast cultural generalizations here on this podcast.
We're going to have to be very careful.
Yeah, we're going to get in trouble for this.
But they have a tendency to build and grow companies in a very homogenous market and then just try to cookie cut apply that elsewhere. Yeah. And, you know, as we've just said, that doesn't work so seamlessly already over in the US. So in terms of things like payment solutions, will Line and Yahoo Japan have an edge there?
Yeah. I mean, I think US companies have had a huge amount of success doing that kind of cookie cutter approach and rolling things out globally. So, I mean, there is something to say for that. But yeah, I think, you know, Asia Pacific is, and it is the, you know, kind of most boring truism that everybody, I'm sure, says about Asia, but it is a bunch of different markets with different people and different cultures and different ideas of how to get things done. So being closer to those nuances does give you an advantage. I think, honestly, what the Japanese are worried about is, you know, are the Chinese companies scaling up across Southeast Asia, that's actually, and you know, it's so difficult to compete with the pockets of the big Chinese tech companies.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they are very depthy.
Depthy. Oh,
what a great word. That's a great word, Tom.
You're not going to leave this one down for
a
while.
No, definitely not. Anyway, moving on to the next news story. Sort of originating as a US story, but something that I wanted to...
We just love the US.
We love the US. Just wanted to use it as a way to talk about the connected TV environment, I suppose, here in APAC and also globally. So Disney's Hulu posted some revenue numbers earlier this week. And what I found interesting about this was that it's really highlighting how their sort of hybrid ad-funded and subscription model is progressing over in the US. So they were talking about having made some $670 million US in ad-funded revenue in 2019 and $1.27 billion US in subscriptions. And I think that's really interesting because it's not just talking about their sort of ability to build a subscriptions business, but they're still, you know, got a really significant ad-funded model as well. I think this is something that adds another layer to the streaming wars that we've been talking about a lot being undertaken in the US. And I wonder if it's a little bit of evidence as to the value of ad-funded models for other global markets to be looking at. So the conversation we've been having in exchange, well, just for a bit of context, Tom, lately is, you know, streaming in the US completely different to every other global market. Netflix, you know, there's divided opinion amongst ExchangeWise staff, but Netflix bound to develop an ad-funded model outside of the US because they need to build their subscriber base or their user base. And in other markets, particularly in APAC, people won't be willing to take on high-value subscriptions.
Yeah.
So is this sort of Hulu hybrid model a little bit of a reflection back to the rest of the TV world that ad-funded really does work and can be extra added value? Mm. What does it say about how streaming services are building their businesses over here in Asia, because we know it's you know, extremely different? And also, what does it say, I suppose a bit similar to our previous story, about US streaming giants trying to set up businesses in Asia? Are they going to be looking at ad-funded opportunities or are they just going to go, you know, headfirst down the subscription path? What's your point of view?
Yeah, I mean, there's tons of interesting stuff in there. I think, you know, the first thing I always think about when looking at mixed monetization models is it's not really anything new. I mean, you look at mature media businesses and they tend to trend towards mixed monetization. I mean, look at, you know, the oldest media business that we still have around, possibly, maybe Out of Home's older, but press, you know, magazines. Mm. And what, you know, what was the kind of press magazine funding model? Well, it was, you know, it was partly kind of cover price. It was partly subscription. It was partly ad funded. And that's kind of brand ads, and then partly classified advertising. And then, you know, maybe they'd be involved in events or, you know, premium phone lines or, you know, whatever, a range of different ways that they leverage their, you know, connection assets. With consumers, yeah. their assets to drive monetization. So I think this idea that there is, you know, somehow a pure subscription only model out there that is going to fund the media business, I mean, it doesn't really bother me, you know, from a philosophical standpoint, whether that there is or not. But I think it's unlikely. I think most businesses will trend towards mixed monetization.
Yeah.
And, you know, perfectly, you know, perfectly normal when we look at it from a historical perspective. So I wouldn't be surprised if all businesses end up like that. I think here in Asia Pacific, to speak to, you know, that point that, you know, that you've made, I think it's less likely that a model driven by subscription will work. You know, there are a ton of OTTs across Asia Pacific and, you know, some in Southeast Asia. India has an incredibly vibrant market. There are 40 different local OTTs socking it out in India, all of whom have, you know, kind of decent user bases, all of whom are buying, big chunks of content. The India strategy, from what I can see, tends to be buy rights to an Indian cricket series or the IPL or something like that, and use that to get users on board,
yeah.
and then kind of, you know, and then sell ads off the back of it, sell sponsorships, whatever it is. So
that's what BT did in the UK. Didn't work very well.
Right.
So,
okay.
Not enough cricket viewers, I'd say.
Well, BT tried to do it with the Premiership. There's plenty of those viewers, yeah. but no, didn't really work.
That's interesting. I wonder why.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's worked in India from what I can see. But okay, so I mean, tons of different, you know, OTTs or, you know, VOD platforms, mostly looking to start introducing an ad-funded model,
yeah.
Into their platform. Yeah, I mean, and not always with kind of intrusive pre-roll ads. I mean, a lot of them are looking at kind of sponsorships or kind of rewarded advertising, i.e. you've watched episode one, you want to watch episode two, you know, would you like to watch an ad beforehand or would you like to kind of sign up for a subscription? Mm-hmm. So, you know, a little bit more kind of respectful, maybe microtransactions enabled by the kind of payment infrastructure that sits out here in Asia Pacific. Yeah.
Interesting. Lindsay, what's your perspective on this?
So looking at the Hulu perspective, I think that Hulu represents great opportunity for ad-funded models. Basically, just echoing everything Tom just said, I'm just going to copy what you said. It makes my life easier.
Yes, fine.
Fair enough.
Copyrighted it already, yeah, so you're going to have to pay
great.
Me.
I have to pay now. Christ.
Along with SoftBank?
Yes. Doftbunk, because it eventually turned into
Bunk, the German version.
Oh, yeah,
Doftbunk.
Doftbunk.
Or just no, wait, so that's Daft Punk, isn't it? Daft Punk would launch SoftBank if it was their DTC.
It's the love child of I don't know what anymore.
With some great ideas flowing this morning.
But Hulu represents a great opportunity for ad monetization when it comes to OTT, and they have proven that. And I don't want to sound like a broken record because it feels like I talk about it every week, but the appetite for advertising in the US when it comes to TV is very, very different from other markets, yes, and other
right.
regions.
Okay.
And that's something that has to be considered. So for example, Hulu now have or will be having ads on the pause screen, like any possible option to have an ad somewhere, Hulu will put it there. And that may work in markets like the US, but it's not going to work everywhere. So they have to think about, if they're going to roll out to other markets, have to think about a market by market strategy and localize it rather than just think the US cookie cutter approach will work everywhere. But also, I think, you know, when there were concerns that Disney likes a sub model, obviously Disney's just launched Disney Plus, and with their owning stake in Hulu, they would then turn Hulu into a sub model as well, because that's what works in the US. But I think these companies in the US are now starting to realize, actually, we need to think about, we can't just make everything subscription model, because people are getting, there's subscription blindness happening now. No one has a clue what they're paying for, a clue where to find what shows. Again, that is a very US centric problem. Mm. It's not quite the same over here. It's not quite the same in Europe either. But they need to think about how they diversify and turn it into kind of new opportunities for them.
Well, I think those dynamics are going to exist everywhere in the, you know, subscription blindness. There was a really interesting piece of research about what's the kind of optimal number of subscriptions, and it turns out it's three.
Mm.
So
I can believe that.
Yeah, I agree. 100%.
And if you know, and thinking about Disney as a, you know, if you have a family, or out here in Asia, actually, I mean, Disney, so the kind of Marvel universe, has far more cut through against, you know, a broader age range than, you know, it does maybe in the West. So, you know, Disney is going to be one of those. Mm. So Disney will get a subscription. I don't know. Do Netflix get one? Amazon Prime probably gets one, because you kind of, you know, you need
the
Amazon Prime.
And the extra in services your... that come
yeah,
with
exactly.
it.
Yeah, totally.
You get other stuff again, with it. That actually raises a good point, though, because that, again, is something that works in Asia. Don't just give people something that they can stream. Give people other services on top of that.
I was going to say, it's sort of like a TV version of a super utility app, right?
Exactly.
You do other things within it.
Yeah.
And that's what Amazon does so well everywhere else, is trying to do in certain markets in Asia.
But then also, we talk about how, you know, TV subscriptions, or, you know, content subscriptions are really based on exactly that, the content. So people go where the content is.
Yeah.
So then won't it depend quite heavily on who's got the content? You rightly made a very good point there, Tom, that's where Disney Plus will do well, because they've got an enormous audience for a lot of their owned and operated content. Amazon have got other services to offer with it, but they will need some kind of localized popular content in other regions, won't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
For people to really...
Totally. And I think they're, you know, businesses, you know, like iFlix here in Southeast Asia, starting to make, you know, investments in content. But we haven't seen, I mean, what Netflix, I mean, Netflix has just blown the market apart. I mean, you know, all TV, even Hollywood, they're starting to, you know, have a real impact on TV production, you know, film production, just the amount of money that they're putting into the market.
Yeah.
We haven't seen that here in Asia Pacific. We haven't seen that amount of investment in content by new style VOD OTT platforms. But then again, it's a little bit more mixed up anyway. I mean, somewhere like, you know, China, it's difficult to kind of find the line between TV and OTT and VOD. So, yeah.
Mm. I mean, the marketplace is also extremely complex, right? And our sort of understanding of it it has a lens over the top of that. So we tend to understand it and interpret it based on our own sort of habits and experiences.
Yep.
Because I also imagine that there are marketplaces like India, where you said earlier on, you know, that they've got some, 40 or 50 odd potential options. There must be that. They must be considering all sorts of different models to get people.
Absolutely. I think one of the engaged. Main sort of kind of dividing lines when thinking about OTT or VODs in Asia Pacific is kind of mobile versus connected TV, right?
And by that you mean TV screens?
Yeah, TV screens. So, I mean, there's tons of both, but, you know, there is a real, you know, there are Asian markets where we're looking at 80%, you know, kind of mobile only behavior. Now, of course, you know, they will have a TV screen, but they might be kind of solo screening or whatever it is. So kind of mobile, you know, OTT usage versus connected TV is one of the big splits. And the kind of platforms, the kind of ecosystems that you see emerging as to whether a market is perhaps what we might think of as a more mature connected TV type market, where people will have boxes or Apple TVs, or, you know, ways of connecting stuff to a big TV, versus, you know, mobile streaming markets.
But that then raises the interesting point around, and we've had this conversation already a few times since being in Singapore for like a day, you and I, Rachel, is this definition around CTV, connected TV, and we talked about it at ATS Singapore in June as well, that there is, and this is not an APAC problem, this is a global problem, the definition of what TV viewing is, what connected TV viewing is, because some would argue you could bring mobile into that conversation because so much TV, and I'm using air quotes, is used on a mobile. But then if you're looking at it from an advertising opportunity, the media planning and buying part of this conversation then becomes even more complex, because how do they fit into your line on a media plan?
Yeah.
And what's mobile video, what's TV, what's connected TV, am I buying, when I'm buying like OTT ad inventory, where will it actually get watched? And then what for me is interaction, what for me is engagement, how do I measure performance on that? I think that is where I think there'll be an interesting conversation, and that's going to only evolve. In APAC, it's more interesting because it's all mobile anyway. So when you talk about CTV opportunity in APAC, by and large, you're talking about the kind of the minimal penetration of big TVs. And it's minimal because it's a it's a poor region. Yes, we have the wider middle class, but actually it's a poor region. So not many of these people have TVs in the first place. Mm. So they are viewing it on mobile. So from that perspective, you're going, oh, the opportunity here is in mobile, not in CTV. Mm. But actually, when we talk about it from a European perspective, we are asking that question, where does the where's the crossover? And if I am buying, like, say, a broadcast VOD, where are people watching it? Are they watching it on their tablet, on their mobile, on the TV? Am I able to measure that? And can I buy it any differently in the first place?
Yeah.
And that, I think, is where, for me, it becomes very, very interesting. Yeah. And also, the opportunity lies.
Yeah, and I mean, also, kind of, you know, does it matter where they're watching it? I mean, it depends.
I guess it does for when you're planning it.
Yeah.
But
as a consumer...
No, it doesn't.
For you, a screen is a screen, so it doesn't make a difference.
And particularly in some markets, a screen is a screen as well, right? So if I'm thinking about European and even just, you know, behaviours and habits in London, people will almost, particularly because most people commute, will almost watch as much TV, air quotes, on their phone as they would on a TV device at home, because the 45 minutes either side of their day, they're using it to catch up on an episode of X or Y, and that might be Amazon Prime, Netflix, or it might even be streamed content if they're somewhere where they can get a Wi-Fi signal. So, you know, I think that in Europe, we tend to refer to connected TV actually not involving a TV screen at all, just any device that you might use. But here and in other markets, it becomes much more complex.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, one of the biggest distinctions between that kind of big TV and mobile is actually it challenges something that is fundamental to our understanding of how we do digital marketing, which is that digital marketing is about one-to-one addressability to a consumer. That's how all of our tracking is set up currently. That's how all of our targeting is set up. That's how we think about it. I mean, at some point we might get onto the fun conversation around the death of the cookie. Mm. But I mean, a lot of that is predicated on the idea that the most important thing is that one-to-one addressability with the consumer. But actually, when you're talking about big TVs, you're talking about a household device. And actually, when we look at the future of stuff, the future of the future, we're talking about more household type devices. We're talking about voice devices, we're talking about TVs, and we're talking about devices that are in family homes. We're talking about screens on fridges in offices. We're talking about a range of different targeting and measurement opportunities that go far beyond one-to-one addressability. So that's when I think about the distinction between the two. Yeah. That's one of the big things that I think about.
That makes a lot of sense. So it ties into, we shouldn't be targeting based on channel, we should be targeting based on audiences, and our audience is evolving. So from what you're saying, you know, we were in a world where it was broadcast, and sort of this narrow cast one-to-one idea was far too difficult. It's far too difficult to target, far too difficult to measure.
Yeah.
But actually, now we've got there, we're actually moving away from it again and going back to sort of what the one-to-many conversation.
Yeah. But I mean, that's natural, and the Internet of Things is going to drive that further. And, you know, we're going to have to get our heads back into that space aren't we?
Yeah. Okay, third news story. Back to the US again. Amazon's having launched a live video content offering. So from my reading of this...
Explain this one because it was very much...
Have you not had a look at the deck?
That was embedded in the article, wasn't it? I haven't seen the deck.
Yeah.
Okay. It was embedded in the article. Yeah. I mean, from what I could gather, this is basically like a modern day version of QVC. It's a live shopping channel. And I presume it could cover anything from sort of, kind of detailed rundown of the product. But it might also even cover things like a bit of unboxing of products. So it's not actually, well who knows, because it would be effectively down to the advertiser to decide how to take that forward. But it's something they're doing. They've a studio in New York where they set up systems for people to come and live stream this activity. They also try to gear it towards, you know, special, unique holiday periods or shopping days like Black Friday, Cyber Monday, those sorts of things. Mm. It's clearly a diversification of their advertising offering. And it's really interesting because it's, firstly, let's think about the format on which people would watch it. So again, it's that entire conversation about whether it's a one-to-one handheld device that people would be consuming that sort of stuff on. Secondly, it's a conversation about how Amazon further diversifying their advertising offering. And then thirdly, it's also a conversation about what that does for the advertiser. You know, we're seeing from some sort of, you know, commentators, a little bit of sort of concern from advertisers that Amazon is getting so much of their sort of data and their insights that it's enabling them to better copycat their products. Do brands further trust Amazon to actually go into an Amazon studio and wax lyrical about the details of their products, knowing all the while that Amazon is also a shop and a marketplace in itself? So it's just really interesting. And then the follow on from that, which is the thing I'm particularly interested in your perspective on, Tom, is, you know, isn't this potentially a huge opportunity in a marketplace like Asia where, you know, you've got a lot of people consuming content on mobile devices, and you can imagine it's a perfect environment for which that sort of, you know, shopping channel experience could be consumed?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, Amazon in Asia Pacific is Singapore, Japan, India and Australia. So, I mean, they've got a good, you know, they've got a good footprint, but, you know, not extensive. Ali, who also own Lazada, who do most of Southeast Asia. So it's not extensive.
Stop kicking me, Rachel. No, Jesus Christ.
I actually thought that was the table. So I've just realised, 40 minutes into the podcast, that what I've been kicking is not the table leg, it's Lindsay's foot.
Yeah, I'm done. I'm over it now. Sorry.
Poor Lindsay.
Unbelievable. I'm an attack by my
bit
own
of bullying
boss.
Going
an expression
on.
Of pain on her face. Yes. Yeah. Nothing you've ever seen before.
Carry on, Tom. Sorry to interrupt you.
Well,
very rude.
I mean, absolutely. So, I mean, Amazon, you know, interesting. And I think it's, you know, I one of the other things that I kind of think of when I look at this is, again, it's kind of the Western way of using the internet, which, because there is quite a lot of existing infrastructure and quite a lot of maturity in terms of media, is how do we take these things and make them digital. So, you know, kind of, you know, the first thing of the internet is, let's take a shop and kind of like put it online. Let's take a shopping channel and like put it online as part of like a shop. You know, so there is some evolution, but it's still kind of like, how can we just take an old model and
digitize
kind of and digitize it? And I think what we see here in Asia is something entirely different. You know, and that I think is probably, you know, 5 years ahead of the kind of thing that we see Amazon doing. So, I mean, the way that...
You didn't have the old models in the first place.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it sort of did, but I mean, they weren't as kind of prevalent because there wasn't the reach, there wasn't the scale, you know, just not the maturity of media and distribution. So, yeah, because of a lack of old models, new models emerge that are more advanced, more interesting, more dynamic. So I would say, I mean, and especially China is absolutely kind of, you know, the poster child for this. In China, e-commerce is already a content-driven and social experience. Mm. So Chinese e-commerce platforms invest so much money in creating content to get people to spend time in their shops. And that is everything from, you know, live shopping feeds, shopping channels, to, you know, all sorts of content, best bags to buy, whatever it is. Mm. But I mean, just content. And also kind of top that up with influencers, get influencers to create content, get influencers to do live shopping feeds, create a really kind of social experience. And of course, it's all, you know, it's often all run within WeChat. So, you know, an app within, you know, the super app that is WeChat. So it's kind of, you know, it's already like what Amazon are doing, but it's sort of on steroids. It's, you know, kind of sliced right through with influencer marketing and all sorts of other stuff. And influencers, I mean, the other thing that's interesting in China is influencers used to really drive results. I think we've maybe got the view in the West, looking at what we do on Instagram, we don't really have those kind of commerce models yet around influencers. I mean, they're beginning to emerge, but a lot of the time it might be posting a nice picture of you doing a yoga pose on a sunset beach on your Instagram feed with a product, which is something that I do a lot, as you can imagine.
I imagine maybe we won't see any of us doing that.
I am a key yoga influencer.
Yeah, I can see that, Tom.
But yeah, you know, so really inflected through with commerce. So what are we getting? What is being sold off the back of this feed, this, you know, content, whatever it is? And then, you know, the other thing that you have emerging now are influencer studios, where some of the older influencers who know all these techniques are now kind of a bit like, oh, it's tiring doing this, maybe, or, you know, maybe my brand is a little bit sort of tailing off. Right, how can I, you know, I'm going to build up a range of new influencers. So I'm going to get these influencers, you know, get them famous and start to monetize them using the techniques that I know so well. So yeah, I mean, the entire thing is just like what Amazon is doing, but on steroids, I would say.
And it's interesting because when we first talked about this amongst the team yesterday, I think one of the first things that came up is, well, so who would be featured on these Amazon Live streaming shopping channels? Is it famous people? Is it influencers? So,
yeah,
you know, you can see that's where people's minds go immediately. Yeah. And we don't know a huge amount of detail about the Amazon offering, not having completely absorbed the deck like Tom did. But you can see that it's ripe for heading off in that direction.
Yeah.
Lindsay?
I mean, maybe it's spending too much time in conversation with people like you, Tom, that live and breathe this region and everything that it stands for and everything that's going on in it. But there was a quote in the article that I literally laughed out loud when I read it. I lolled. Because this is why Amazon Live just makes no sense to me. Well, it does, but I'm going to quote you. Amazon is very savvy in the ways it creates new kinds of shopping that really sit at the intersection of media and retail. Amazon Live, is it a media experience or retail? It's both. That's pretty innovative. Eye roll, but it remains to be seen whether or not it has long-term scalability and viability. But from the perspective of innovation, it could be game-changing. Sorry, but
it's already happened.
Massive eye roll. Like, honestly, what are you talking about? First of all, QVC already existed and has done for years, yeah, as does every other shopping channel.
Yes.
That is not innovative. And they were the original DTCs, really, yeah, that Amazon have come and just kind of shat all over. Mm. But secondly, Tom, everything you just said about what's happening in this region is what Amazon Live is on steroids.
Yeah.
They've already done it and they didn't create it from what used to exist as retail. They've kind of created it out of nothing.
Yeah.
And Amazon are just kind of, well, copying it. Mm. It's not, that to me, I don't understand why it's innovation. I really don't. I'm perplexed by it.
Maybe it's just innovation because, you know, I think, I actually thought that that quote was a little bit of a hook to talk about the retail industry and the death of retail in the US, which is a bit of an obsession of the consumer industry. You know, more bricks and mortar stores going out of business, you know, tougher times for big US retail giants, US retail department stores going down the tubes. It's just an opportunity. It's opportunism, basically, is where I thought that quote was going. Because otherwise, Lindsay, you're absolutely right. There's nothing innovative in that. All they're doing is rearranging, the deck chairs, basically. This is something that's already existed and they're just...
But not on the Titanic because it's not sinking. On something that's growing.
Yes.
When the deck chairs on...
The yoga beach where Tom's doing his Instagrammable pose.
I'm doing it right now, if you can imagine, out there. We're on a beach.
Oh, there's no downward dog going on in this podcast, listeners.
Oh, Rachel, what on earth, man. No, the yoga pose.
But I mean, your point of the death of retail, China is the biggest e-commerce market in the world. So, yeah. But I mean, there's still tons, you know, of China that isn't, that is offline retail. Mm. When you're looking at markets in, you know, Singapore is still only about 5 or 6% online retail.
Mm.
You know, that, which is nuts. And, you know, other markets across Southeast Asia, you know, maybe 10% online retail. So there's a hell of a long way to go. And I think there's interestingly, that's one area where the US and Europe is probably ahead, the share of retail that is online.
Yeah that's true.
So we're Is that sort of to do a little bit with infrastructure? Is it because, you know, last mile delivery is difficult in some Asian regions and the infrastructure doesn't exist to make it sophisticated enough?
So that is what the US really nails.
Absolutely.
They've got that. They've tried to merge the online and the offline, and that's something they had to do because of the existing legacy infrastructure. And you've got the Instacarts, the DoorDashes of the world, and then kind of beyond that, kind of the Uber Eats, and they have really managed to do that.
And I think, just in my own experience, that's why online shopping, beyond things like groceries or other convenience things, online shopping for clothes, shoes, that sort of stuff, that's why that's taken off in places like the UK, particularly in places like London. Two reasons. First is it gets delivered to your door and it's really easy and convenient, and there's so many places you can pick it up or have it delivered to you. It's very reliable. The second thing is you don't then have to deal with all the crowds down at the actual shops.
Although when I was in New York a few weeks ago, my Uber Eats driver ended up being a walker. And walked 3 miles with my food. I mean, I could have done that, for Christ's sake.
It was ridiculous.
It took the poor man 45 minutes to get to my hotel.
I mean, what
by which point the food was just pointless.
Yeah, well, it would have been a little cold.
I felt really sorry for him. I was like, it's freezing out there. Uber Eats, you shouldn't let people do that. But the man that delivered it, yeah, I loved him. It was brilliant.
Is that actually an option? You could
no,
order a walker.
It's not an option. Select a walker.
It is absolutely not an option. You select something thinking you're going to get somebody who is at least on some kind of moving vehicle that goes beyond
the car. Oh, it's a cold night, so I'm going to select a walker, yeah. Says Lindsay herself.
There's no money back on choosing a walker. I did not choose a walker. I thought it would be delivered in the normal
method. Did he explain why he was walking method.
No, it's something
did
it's
the
common.
Vehicle break down?
I think that's common.
Really?
Yeah.
So what, are they not telling
on the
Uber
app,
Eats
that your Uber Eats deliverer, or whatever they call them, is walking. And you're going, I'm sorry, what?
That is mad.
He's 3 miles away.
Mind you, I think I told you this. My delivery guy the other night was walking down the street too, but I think it's just because he parked his moped
left a vehicle.
And also couldn't see the numbers on the... It was dark, it was rainy. Yeah. He needed a closer perspective, so he decided to get off his moped and wander up and down the street. Anyway, Tom, we're distracting you again.
What are we
going to say something a little bit more sensible?
I don't know, was I? last mile, I mean.
Yes,
yeah.
Infrastructure. Is that what's holding online shopping in this region?
Kind of, and it's pushed it in two ways, hasn't it? I mean, in one respect, that lack of infrastructure has led to, we just talked about all of the wonderful stuff that's going on, you know, in e-commerce, across e-commerce platforms in China. Also, you know, the other thing that we've seen is so much more online innovation in the offline world, which is, you know, payment infrastructure, deliveries, you know, micro last mile delivery options within these super apps,
yep.
As a result of trying to get over, mitigate the friction, you know, caused by lack of infrastructure. But then, yeah, I mean, in other ways that lack, so it's kind of, you know, it's pushed innovation, but in the other sense, that lack of infrastructure has held back online retail and other sort of parts of the digital ecosystem in other areas. So, I mean, it's kind of, it's lumpy is what you'd say. Mm. Driven lots of innovation in some places, kind of held it back a bit in others. But I think, you know, now that payment is, you know, getting sorted, last mile is getting sorted, you know, we will see online retail absolutely fly. I mean, there was a recent Temasek Google report to use the G word, which we...
You're allowed. It's okay, Tom.
Absolutely.
There you go. You know, e-commerce absolutely flying. I mean, double digit, you know, year-on-year growth over the next
globally,
few years.
Here in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Mm. But just nuts growth.
Because there was one other thing I was thinking about with regards to online shopping here in Asia. Was someone telling me something about quite a few Southeast Asian countries where there are convenience stores everywhere? Not necessarily, I mean, here in Singapore it might be 7-Eleven, but in, you know, Indonesia or Malaysia or Vietnam, it'll be like, you know, a little corner store effectively that's stocked full of stuff you might need. So would there also be another thing that needs to change, which is the cultural sort of attitudes to where you go to get stuff?
Yes.
Or is that in some Southeast Asian regions almost more of an opportunity for your sort of delivery drivers? In fact, you don't go to that corner store anymore. You just get the delivery guy to go and not walk it back, but, you know, moped it back or something
like that. Don't walk it back.
yeah, totally. I mean, so it's the mom and pop stores.
Shop,
yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, you know, supermarkets are... You know, spreading. There's definitely opportunity around driving more purchase.
Like. Yeah. Lindsay's showing me the time. Right, time to move on to the second part of the podcast.
It's not even time of the podcast. It's kind of that time in general because just thinking about meetings afterwards. But
oh yes, good point.
Yeah, probably let our
good
meeting
point.
Person.
We do all have day jobs, so let's crack on. Second part of the podcast. More of a focus on what you're up to at Ad Colony, Tom. We were having a chat before starting recording about the exciting world of gaming and, you know, being a mobile first company. It's a really exciting time for you. Tell us a little bit about what's happened in 2019, what particularly you're working on or looking forward to for 2020.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, our focus at Ad Colony in 2020 is absolutely about gaming. So gaming is, you know, we know it is one of the hottest, buzziest topics out there.
That's why I'm calling it out.
Hottiest. I like it.
It's depthiest, it's hottest. there is so much heat around gaming in a, you know, in a really positive way. So, you know, 2020 we feel is going to be, you know, is going to be a really great year. We've seen it building up over 2019 as brands and marketers become more comfortable with gaming, and in particular with mobile gaming as a channel where they can execute against customers at scale. Any customer, you know, whatever gender, whatever age it is. And it's kind of, it's, I think one of the things that we've done over 2019 is really help delineate the difference between the mobile gaming audience, which is, you know, mobile gaming is 80% reach in most markets in Asia Pacific. So, I mean, we're not talking about gamers. We're just talking about people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is not a small select audience of a particular demographic. This is much, much broader than that.
Totally. It's any age, any gender, you know, whatever it is, luxury, whatever. They're all present in mobile gaming. It's 80% reach. Of course they're present in mobile gaming. Yeah. I mean, mobile gaming has got more reach than social media in a lot of markets in Asia. It's not dissimilar in the West, but maybe mobile gaming doesn't have quite as much reach as social in every market. In Asia, absolutely does. But kind of delineating that difference between mobile gaming, which is a mass reach channel, around 80% reach, and then looking at kind of gamers. So, you know, still important and still gamers present within that mobile gaming audience, but gamers as being, you know, maybe 40 to 45% of a market is constituted of gamers. So people who play console games or PC, and that being a slightly different audience that requires slightly different treatment. And then, you know, streamers, so people who either stream or watch streams, 10 to 15% of the market. Esports, people who watch esports, interested in esports, 5% of the market. And kind of, you know, just getting that real distinction in brands and marketers' minds between, at one end, what is just a big reach opportunity within a kind of sort of professional brand safe environment, to at the other end, you know, an audience that are gamers that need to be treated like gamers, talked to respectfully in a way that, you know, that kind of sinks in with
aligns
their culture.
With what they're doing. Yeah. And to what extent, so if that's been sort of a bit of a feature of 2019, kind of getting to grips with that sort of audience segmentation and audience profile across that full range you've just described, to what extent do you feel that brands and marketers are really on board with that? You know, has it still been a year of education, you know, sort of some detailed conversations, perhaps when you're working together with agencies and other partners to kind of really, you know, dig behind some of those sort of ideas that people might have had about gaming audiences before? Or are you seeing already some brands really starting to get it? And have you had, I don't know, moments with clients kind of literally popping up going, we're all over gaming, we totally understand the opportunity here?
I think this year we've started to see that. I think last year there was a lot of kind of early buzz. We probably all saw the stuff going on with Fortnite, you know, Fortnite doing $500 million a month on just selling outfits, virtual outfits. I mean, amazing.
Yeah.
You know, how they people.
Amazing.
So, you know, lots of buzz in 2018, getting it onto people's radars. 2019, we're seeing some, you know, some of the early adopting brands starting to execute. And I mean, early adopters, obviously, you know, DTCs, digital native type brands who are always doing smart things, looking for performance, yada, yada. So you'd expect them to be there and to be comfortable with that. But more interestingly, you know, it's the typical, it's the autos, it's the FMCGs who are just suddenly understanding that, just like social media, you know, mobile gaming is just a big reach opportunity. That's all it is. I can just execute reach against my, you know, against my audience really, really easily in one place. And that's it. And then, you know, kind of following on from that right now, where we're sort of in kind of thinking about 2020 season, planning with a lot of our big clients, we've been through the planning process, and we're actually getting, you know, clients coming back to us and saying, what's our gaming strategy for next year? And they're treating gaming as a channel in the same way that they treat social, in the same way that they treat OTT VOD. You know, gaming is a real channel for them. They need, they understand they need to do something there, and they're really keen to push on.
Finally. So. And what's your perception of how that's shaking out here in APAC versus other regions? So what are you, for example, what are your ad colony colleagues sort of talking about over in the US? Are they having the same experience and the same conversations? Like you've just pointed out, actually the profile of gaming audiences is not a million miles away in global regions. You know, we've all got this perception of Asia being very sort of mobile first and also very gaming focused, but actually is it that different elsewhere? What's your perception?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I don't think the profile is that different elsewhere. There is a slight nuance towards, you know, gaming here in Asia, but it's only very slight, and it probably exists more down the bottom of the funnel around kind of esports and streaming.
Yeah,
as opposed to mobile gaming, which is just hyper casual. You know, it's just everybody sitting on the tube or whatever it is. So, yeah, and I mean, we see a range of different kind of engagement levels across Asia Pacific. You know, somewhere like Australia, which is the 51st state kind of thing.
Very well described.
Yeah, so, you know, we see a lot more kind of, I guess, questions around mobile gaming. Is this really the right channel for my brand? Has this really got the reach? Like, you know, we're still at a slightly earlier kind of stage in Australia in terms of moving the needle. Other markets where gaming is a lot more accepted, you know, we, you know, the needle has already been moved. We've already got those big early adopter advertisers on board. Next year will be the rest of the market kind of following on. And so, yeah, I mean, in the US, I think probably a bit more kind of early stages, the needle is starting to rattle and starting to go up, but it's not quite getting there yet.
And what about, you know, we're all pretty familiar with advertisers and marketers and agencies actually, you know, voicing concern over mobile environments, which would obviously include gaming as well. What's changed in that in the intervening 12 months with regards to those issues? Is it that you know, marketers and advertisers and agencies are understanding the nuances of how to target those audiences more and perhaps the tools and platforms that are available? Or is it that people are just getting, and so therefore is that just making them feel a little bit more confident in those environments? Was there a bit of a misunderstanding about the about some of the issues that they felt they might face in those environments? Or are we still really grappling with lots of you know, safety and fraud issues in the environment?
Yeah, I mean, so there's so much going on in there. I mean, I think at the top line, you know, where does most spend go right now? It's going into social environments, right? And I think, you know, the first conversation that that we as an industry and that we as individuals have with our clients is really like, you have brand safety concerns with, you know, or environmental concerns with mobile gaming, which is a professional, pretty static, well-designed. I mean, you know, hyper-casual games look really fucking cool, actually. You know, I love the aesthetic of that. It's kind of like vaporwave style. But anyway, whatever, without getting too niche. You know, social
while you're doing your yoga, obviously, you're also doing your hyper-casual.
But social is such a challenged environment.
Yeah, I mean, so why should people be viewing it? You'll put money in Facebook, but you won't put it in gaming.
Yeah. Where did we get to the stage where user-generated content somehow represented premium? And I expect a lot of it was to do with pictures of people doing yoga at sunset on beaches, which is what people's perception of social media possibly is.
Yes.
And that's not what social media is. Social media is a highly challenged environment and always will be. So I think there's, you know, that's a big kind of step. So mobile gaming, you're not trying to advertise to gamers, you're not trying to say this is contextually relevant. All you're trying to say is it's just like a brand safe
environment,
neutral backdrop. That's it. Okay, the second part of it is, I think, you know, we talked a little bit about this earlier on, the industry, some parts of industry infrastructure coming our way. So, you know, the push, you know, the open measurement SDK being pushed out, the adoption of that by different platforms has given security around fraud, around viewability, has enabled people to measure brand safety, all sorts of kind of parameters in there, has given people that kind of comfort level. We can see this, we can prove it in the tools that we are used to kind of proving it in a web environment. I mean, the other part that's coming around is obviously kind of, you know, targeting the death of the cookie, as we alluded to earlier. Device IDs are still there, so, you know, that's great.
But your point about the death of the cookie, which we talked about earlier, which is a great one, is that, well, actually, most of the audience is not on the web anyway. They're actually in in-app environments. And while it feels like to me that kind of in the APAC region, the advertiser, when it comes to media budget, the advertisers understand that, and that's where the money is going. So they shouldn't be so worried about the death of the cookie, because that's where the money needs to go anyway, is where the audience is.
Yeah.
In the West, the audience is also in that space, but the budgets don't reflect that.
Yeah, 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 totally.
Is that fair?
Yeah, 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 absolutely. I mean, the death of the cookie is a first world problem. It's, you know, and it comes from a place where, you know, in Western markets, we've had access to the internet for 20 years, and we broadly came from a desktop environment. You know, I remember talking about when's mobile going to happen, but yeah, so desktop, so it's a, you know, it's a web environment. And I think, you know, that as a result of that, there are two things that have happened within the industry. One, the kind of concept of what is premium is represented by, you know, kind of a lot of desktop web brands, press, that kind of stuff. We've got a mixed up idea of what is premium, what represents where people are spending time. And I mean, you know, the second part of it is the infrastructure that we have. The ad tech stacks were built for that environment. You know, they were built for a web environment. They were built for a cookie environment. And loads of work has been done over the past few years getting them, you know, up to speed with an, you know, with an app-based device ID environment where consumers are spending most of their time. But absolutely, Lindsay, to your point, you know, even in the West, consumers are only spending 20 to 30% of their time in a web-based environment anyway. They're spending 70% of their time everywhere else. And I find the kind of the gnashing and wailing over the death of the cookie a little bit sort of
amusing.
Yeah, honestly, come on, you know, move on. It's about other things now.
But I mean, the interesting thing will be when the budgets start to shift, as Lindsay said as well. And do you see that at all in again, any of the business that your counterparts are undertaking over in the US? Do they struggle more to get kind of share of budgets in a mobile environment, or what?
I think budgets are shifting. I think mindsets are shifting. Changing. It's happening right now. You know, and we've just touched on all the drivers for
all
that.
The reasons why.
I really think it's happening right now. Obviously we have walled gardens, you know, Amazon encroaching, so lots of different encroachments on, you know, what you talk about, the open internet, open RTB. Spend the 20%ers.
Yep.
Whether the 20%ers as a group, whether we can defend ourselves, is a kind of bigger question.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So much more we could talk about. So little time, unfortunately.
Well, no time.
Yeah. But that's it. We're out.
Thanks. Thanks very much for highlighting that, Lindsay. Thank you very much, Tom, for hosting us in the Ad Colony offices here in Singapore.
It's been my absolute pleasure.
Ours too. And thanks very much, Lindsay, for doubling up as sound guy.
Oh, you're welcome.
And timekeeper.
Of course.
Slightly poor job, but anyway,
well,
on the time.
That's yeah, I'm sorry.
And that was the Mad Tech Podcast. Thanks for listening.